Welcome to the deep dive. Get ready, because we're about to embark on a really fascinating journey into the world of old genealogical records.
It's a world full of puzzles, that's for sure.
Definitely. And this is actually the first part of a two-part exploration. Today, we're rolling up our sleeves, diving deep into the time-tested methods that genealogists have relied on for generations.
Yeah, figuring out how they unlocked the secrets held within these often really difficult historical documents.
Think of it as maybe appreciating the craftsmanship of a master locksmith before we explore the world of digital key making next time.
That's a perfect analogy. Before the rise of artificial intelligence, deciphering these aging papers, it really required a unique blend of detective work, linguistic skill, and honestly, sheer perseverance. So today we'll be uncovering the strategies involved, the often surprising obstacles they encountered, and the satisfying triumphs that come with piecing together the past using these traditional approaches.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because as anyone who's ever tried to read, say, their great-grandparents' scrawled handwriting knows, it's more than just blurry ink, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking about encountering words that have basically vanished from modern usage. It's like stumbling into a linguistic time capsule.
Exactly.
For instance, you might come across a word like pedare. I mean, that's not exactly something you hear every
Not
day.
at all. And that's the thing. The English language isn't static. It's constantly evolving, like an organism. We often talk about Old English, Middle English, Modern English, distinct periods, right? But even within those, words are constantly being born and then fading away.
So you're dealing with layers of change.
Precisely. Genealogical records can span centuries, meaning you're potentially dealing with multiple layers of linguistic shifts. Imagine trying to understand a modern text just filled with, say, 18th century slang. It'd be tough.
Okay, so when you're faced with a word that looks utterly alien, I mean, where do you even begin?
Well, the first step, it might sound obvious, but it's crucial, is to really scrutinize the document. Take your time.
Just stare at it.
Well, yeah, and maybe even try writing down the perplexing word yourself. The goal here is first to rule out simple errors in transcription, stuff caused by faded ink or unclear handwriting. Sometimes what looks like a bizarre word is just, I don't know, a poorly formed letter or maybe a smudge that obscures part of it.
Like trying to decipher a doctor's prescription, always a classic challenge.
Exactly like that sometimes. But okay, let's say you've confirmed the letters as best you can. What's the next move?
What then?
Then we start thinking about some common linguistic hurdles. One big one is abbreviations. In older documents, especially like legal ones, you'd often find words and phrases shortened just to save space, save time.
Makes sense.
You might see just a few letters representing an entire term. The trick here is you got to consult specialized dictionaries or abbreviation keys, things that focus on historical or legal terminology. And actually, it's incredibly helpful to create your own running list of abbreviations you encounter frequently in your specific research. It becomes your personal key,
That's a clever idea, building your own personalized Rosetta Stone for your family's documents. What other linguistic gremlins tend to pop up?
Misspellings are another very, very frequent challenge. You have to remember that standardized spelling, well, that's a relatively recent invention.
Not like today where everything's spell checked.
Exactly. It really only gained traction after widespread education in the 20th century. Before that, how a word was spelled could vary quite a bit, sometimes even within the same document.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So if you're stuck on a word, try saying it out loud. Focus on the sounds. Does it phonetically resemble a word you know, even if the spelling looks completely unfamiliar?
So sound it out like you're back in primary school, a linguistic detective following pronunciation clues. Makes sense.
It often works.
Now, what happens when a word looks familiar, but it just doesn't seem to fit the context at all?
That's a big clue. It's a sign you might be dealing with a variation in English itself. Even between, say, the US and the UK today, there are noticeable differences, right? Word usage, meaning spelling.
Like sidewalk versus pavement.
Precisely. Resources like British English A to Z specifically address these kinds of things, and it goes even deeper than national differences sometimes.
How so?
Well, depending on your ancestors' region, they might have spoken a local dialect with its own unique vocabulary. There used to be, and in some cases still are, numerous regional terms for something as common as, say, a donkey.
Never thought of that.
So, Being aware of potential geographical variations is crucial. It's almost like the language has its own local accents, but with words, too.
It's like discovering a whole new flavor of English. And sometimes it's not even English at all, is it?
Exactly. Particularly in specific types of documents like property deeds or court records, you're likely to encounter terms from other languages.
Like Latin.
Latin was very common, especially in legal documents. Mm. For example, you might see the phrase habendum et tenendum.
Okay. It sounds very official.
It is. It means, as you might guess, to have and to hold, especially common in land transactions.
Ah, okay.
So for these instances, consulting translation dictionaries or even some online translators that support historical languages can be, well, invaluable.
Okay, so we're part linguist, part codebreaker. What's the next piece of our puzzle? What's strategy number two?
Strategy number two is really internalizing that time and place are incredibly important lenses. You have to view the language through them.
Meaning
a word's definition isn't fixed. It can evolve, sometimes drastically, depending on when and where the document was created. Standardized word usage, the way we largely understand it today, really began to solidify mostly in the Victorian era.
Right.
Before that, you might encounter words that were newly coined but just didn't last, or as we mentioned, those very localized dialect terms.
So a seemingly straightforward word from, say, the 17th century could carry a completely different meaning than it does now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or a subtly different one that changes the whole context. And this is where a resource like the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, becomes so incredibly powerful.
The big one.
The big one. It's not just a list of definitions. It meticulously traces the history of words, showing how their usage and meaning have shifted over centuries with dated examples.
Well, that sounds essential.
It really is. And beyond the OED, special subject dictionaries focusing on a particular historical period or a specific field, like law or medicine or textiles, and also historical dictionaries printed closer to the time of the document.
Hmm.
All these can provide crucial context.
You mentioned regionalisms earlier. Can you give us maybe a specific example of how time and place can dramatically affect a word's meaning, just to make it concrete?
Sure. Well, think about some regional terms that still exist today, right?
You
mentioned sidewalk pavement. Or in certain parts of the U.S., that long sandwich might be a grinder. Elsewhere, it's a sub or a hoagie.
Right. Depends where you are.
Exactly. Now, imagine encountering one of those terms in a historical recipe or maybe a grocery list from a region you're not familiar with. Without that regional context, you might be completely puzzled. What's a grinder doing in a recipe, you know?
Definitely. It really highlights how much local culture is just embedded in the very words we use.
It truly is. And sometimes the meaning isn't immediately obvious, even from the surrounding text. Consider a runaway slave advertisement from, say, 1765. It mentions the person was wearing an old light-colored ratteen and an Osnabrig shirt.
Okay, ratteen, Osnabrigs. I mean, you can probably guess their clothes, right?
You can infer that, yes. But to truly grasp the specifics and the social history they represent, you really need to dig deeper.
And how would a genealogist traditionally go about that digging?
By consulting specialized dictionaries or glossaries. In this case, a resource like Textiles for Colonial Clothing might tell you that Osnabrig was a coarse type of linen cloth often used for workwear or by the poor.
Okay, so it tells you something about status.
Exactly. And a glossary like Colonial American English might define ratteen as a thick woolen stuff, twilled or quilted. Suddenly, these aren't just generic clothes. They provide specific details about the person, the material culture, maybe even their economic situation at the time.
Wow. So it's not just about deciphering the word itself, but also unlocking this little window into the world it came from.
That's the real magic, I think.
That naturally leads us then to our next crucial strategy. The power of looking it up, but as you said, with the right resources, not just any dictionary.
Precisely. Your modern everyday dictionary, the one on your phone or your desk, it simply won't cut it when you're wrestling with archaic terminology or obscure historical terms. You need to seek out resources specific to the time period and the subject matter.
And where can genealogists traditionally find these kinds of linguistic treasures?
Well, there are a wealth of helpful online resources that have become invaluable, even for traditional research methods. Cindy's List, for example, it's fantastic. It has a whole section dedicated to dictionaries and glossaries, linking to just a huge number of sites.
Okay.
You can find everything from general glossaries of historical terms to really specialized dictionaries for specific languages relevant to genealogy, like German or Latin.
So the internet helps even the traditional approach.
Immensely.
Mm.
And there are also online communities like mailing lists and forums focused on old words where you can pose questions to fellow researchers and benefit from that collective knowledge. Someone else might have already figured out that tricky word.
It's great that there's a strong community aspect to this, even in the traditional methods, people helping each other out.
Definitely. Genealogy has always had a strong collaborative element. Now, what about physical resources, like books?
Yeah, the bookshelf approach.
Well, the Oxford English Dictionary still reigns supreme there. Its extensive coverage, the historical quotations showing how word usage evolved, it's indispensable. Even the more concise, shorter Oxford English Dictionary is incredibly helpful. It often covers terminology back to the 1700s, which is relevant for a huge number of genealogical records.
Good to know.
And beyond the OED, don't overlook those specialized dictionaries and reference books you can find in library reference sections, or sometimes used bookstores. They can focus on specific historical periods or niche subjects like law, medicine, textiles, even old types of furniture or tableware, anything that might appear in your ancestors' records, really.
You need a whole reference library sometimes. And what about the dictionaries that were actually in use during the time these documents were created? Is there value in looking at those?
Oh, those can offer fascinating insights, absolutely. But they also present their own set of challenges.
How so?
Early dictionaries weren't comprehensive in the way we expect today. They weren't trying to catalog every single word in existence. For example, the very first English dictionary, Robert Cawdrey's from 1604, it contained fewer than 3,000 words, mostly hard words. Tiny, by today's standards, yeah. Even by the early 19th century, Noah Webster's groundbreaking dictionary, while much larger, still wasn't the exhaustive resource we have now. So while historical dictionaries are incredibly valuable for understanding contemporary usage at that specific moment, they might also be incomplete.
So the word you're looking for might just not be in there.
Exactly. Or they could even be harder to navigate because their definitions and the language they use reflect the era they were compiled in. It's a bit like stepping back in time to understand how people understood words then.
It's like peeling back layers of linguistic history. Okay, so with all these potential word puzzles, is there a way for genealogists to become more efficient? Especially if they're working with a lot of documents from, say, one particular family or time period?
Absolutely. And this brings us to our fourth key strategy, which is really practical. Building your own personal dictionary.
Ah, like the abbreviation list you mentioned earlier.
Sort of, but broader. If you find yourself frequently encountering the same unusual words, or maybe you're working intensively with records from the same family or the same individual or a specific location or time period, it's incredibly beneficial to maintain a running list.
What goes in it?
The word problems you've encountered, the meanings you figured out, and crucially, the resources you consulted to find that meaning. Keep it alphabetized. Over time, you'll develop this highly valuable personal reference tool.
I can see how that would speed things up.
It really can. It significantly accelerates your research and can potentially reveal recurring themes or unique aspects of your family's history and their specific language use.
That's a brilliant idea. It's like creating your own customized glossary tailored precisely to your research needs. Yeah. I love that. Now, having explored all these traditional methods, it's clear they demand a great deal of skill, patience, dedication.
They certainly do.
What were some of the primary challenges that genealogists historically faced when they were relying solely on this manual approach, before computers really changed the game?
Well, the most significant challenge, without a doubt, was the sheer amount of time involved.
Because reading the thing.
Reading, transcribing, manually transcribing long or poorly written documents could take days, even weeks, of really painstaking effort. And this also required specialized skills, particularly in paleography. That's the art of deciphering old handwriting styles.
Which can be like a whole different alphabet sometimes.
It really can. And sometimes you needed a working knowledge of historical languages like Latin or maybe old German script. Then there was also the ever-present risk of human error.
How so?
Both in just transcribing ambiguous handwriting, mistaking one letter for another, and also in misinterpreting obsolete terms or local jargon. It's easy to make a mistake when you're tired or unsure.
I can imagine.
And finally, before the advent of digitization and sophisticated search tools, just locating specific information within vast archives of handwritten documents. I mean, imagine searching for one name in volumes and volumes of unindexed records. It was incredibly laborious.
It sounds like a truly labor-intensive and, often frustrating process. But despite these considerable hurdles, there must have been significant successes achieved through these traditional methods, right? I mean, people built huge family trees.
Absolutely. Huge successes. One of the key ones, maybe slightly intangible, is the deep and intimate familiarity the genealogist gained with the content and context of the records through the very act of manual transcription.
You mean the slow process helped understanding?
Exactly. When you painstakingly copy a document word by word, you develop an understanding of its nuances, its flow, its little details that you might miss by just quickly reading a typed version or a summary.
That's a really interesting point.
And traditional research using historical dictionaries and glossaries, all that digging we talked about, it has led to a profound and nuanced understanding of how language evolved, how regional variations shaped things. It builds real expertise.
And the community helped too.
Immensely. We've seen remarkable collaborative efforts within genealogical communities, both online later on, but also offline, through societies and letters for decades. Researchers pooling their knowledge, helping each other decipher particularly challenging texts or pointing towards resources.
The power of many eyes.
Precisely. And let's not forget the creation of those invaluable resources themselves, like the OED and countless specialized historical dictionaries, all built through decades, sometimes centuries, of meticulous human scholarship. That groundwork is incredible.
It really is.
And maybe one final point. Traditional methods, when executed with care and attention, really prioritize preserving the original text's integrity. Copying exactly what you see, which is a crucial consideration, actually, as we start thinking about automated methods, which we'll get into next time.
That's a great point about integrity. So it's a real testament to human patience, skill, and the power of collaboration in the pursuit of knowledge, wasn't it? Before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, can you quickly summarize the key traditional methods we've discussed for tackling those tricky old genealogical records? Just the highlights.
Sure. So number one, careful initial examination to check the handwriting and rule out simple transcription errors. Number two, understanding common issues like abbreviations and misspellings. Three, accounting for variations in English over time and place and recognizing other languages like Latin.
Okay.
Four, the critical role of using the right dictionaries and resources, the OED, specialized glossaries, historical dictionaries, online tools like Cindy's List. And finally, number five, the value of creating your own personalized dictionary as you go deeper into your specific family history.
Perfect. And it's clear that while these methods demand time and expertise, they've been absolutely fundamental in uncovering countless family stories and connecting us to our past. This has been a truly insightful look at the foundational skills of genealogical research.
Glad we could cover it.
Now, as we look ahead to the second part of our exploration, what can you tell us about what we'll be diving into next time?
Well, next time, we'll be shifting gears quite dramatically. We're moving from the traditional to the technological. We'll be exploring how artificial intelligence, AI, is now being applied to the transcription and translation of these same kinds of genealogical documents.
The future is here, sort of.
Sort of. We'll be comparing these new automated approaches with the traditional methods we've discussed today. We'll look at the advantages they offer. Speed is a big one, obviously. But also the limitations they still face and how these two very different worlds, the human expert and the algorithm, are beginning to intersect in this quest to unlock our family histories.
That sounds like a fascinating next step. And yeah, a real glimpse into the future, or maybe the present, of genealogical research. It'll be intriguing to see how technology is reshaping how we interact with the past.
It definitely will be.
And as we conclude this part of our deep dive, here's a thought for you, our listeners. Considering the profound historical and linguistic knowledge that deep human understanding required to truly interpret genealogical records, not just read them, how might our relationship with these documents evolve as artificial intelligence becomes an increasingly powerful tool in this field?
A good question.
Something to ponder. Join us next time as we continue to explore this compelling intersection of history and technology.